For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as in a cave. We invite you now to join us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell, and Joseph Tomasian. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
And welcome to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Joseph Tomasian, Tim O'Donnell, all three of the cave members here.
Hooray!
In the cave. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous fall afternoon. So the trees have just started turning. It's beautiful. And of course, in Indiana, at least, every it seems like, maybe it's every other fall, happens to also be the middle of politics season. You wind up with football leaves and political ads just coming out the wazoo.
Mudslinging.
Mudslinging and ads. And of course, here in Indianapolis, and I guess across the state, we're having municipal elections. So it's a little more subdued, but you hear the national ads and the national politics beginning to rev up for next year already. So we wind up with a perennial every fall being political season. And
it becomes white noise.
And it's white noise, but there's so much philosophically to discuss when it comes to political ads. Because, you know, going back to even the beginnings of philosophy with Socrates and his questions, his adversaries were the sophists.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a stretch. Maybe this will be the first thing we can discuss. But the modern day sophists are politicians. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Yeah, they're the ones.
I think Aristotle would say that the political man is the philosopher as well.
Well, that's correct, and I think we have some differing views on cities now. We have some differing views on civilization. We have some differing views on what the basis of society is, not only as moderns, but also as Catholics,
right,
from what Socrates had to say. So we do have some differences with Socrates to go through. But no, I think if he were transported into 21st century America and he started to see the ads, I think he would hit the streets pretty quickly.
Yeah,
I think
so. Yeah. The gadfly of Indiana.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you know, the question comes up, how much truth? I mean, as you said, you know, well, the malarkey gets a little thick during political season.
Well, they
season,
use these phrases that are just so overwhelmingly straw man. You know, I think there was one in particular where I heard one opponent was attacking another opponent because he's pro Second Amendment and pro life, and that makes him extreme, an extremist.
Yes,
right.
Yeah, you know, I think we can figure out which is which, but it leads a question. You know, what happens when historic virtue becomes vice, you know?
Right.
And what happens when vice becomes virtue?
Well, I guess there's two questions there. On the one hand, you know, is just extremism in itself bad? I mean, do we want, I guess the joke would be, okay, if you don't have an extreme politician, then you've got a mediocre politician. Do we really want mediocre office holders, or is it kind of both people? Well, they want extremists, but they want extremists on their side.
Well, I don't know that we can say that either. I think extremists have to be countered by centrists, you know. So if you have extreme views versus centrist views, because you can be mediocre and be an extremist, and
I think you can be an extreme centrist.
Yeah,
I don't think there's any sure contradiction there.
I think it depends on what you mean by when the term extreme is being thrown around. I always kind of wonder, like, what I we're always concerned with definitions, like, what is it? A lot of times, I think if it's a political ad, it's not meant in a complimentary fashion necessarily.
No,
it's to say, it's to paint the person as someone one ought to reject because being more moderate is more acceptable.
Sure.
So if you have
right
an extreme position, it's to say, that's well, to infer that you have the wrong.
If you have
you
any
have
position.
Exactly. And
yeah,
at least that second
matter
question, right?
Yeah.
So the first question is, okay, is it better to be moderate or mediocre rather than extreme? But then the second question is, what are you extreme for, right?
And well,
I mean, you would hope somebody would be extremely pro-virtue, right? You'd hope that that would not be an insult to say, you know, I am, and you know, especially when people are being accused of being extremely pro-life, that one resonates as like, well, you know, you're talking about someone being extreme for a particular virtue.
You know, it seems to me, Mark, anytime somebody stands up and digs their heels in to any idea, they're going to be labeled as an extremist. Now you have to you know, portray a certain amount of flexibility in your worldview in order to be accepted. And so if you stand up and say, you know, Palestine is right and Israel's wrong, or Israel is right and Palestine is wrong, you're going to be labeled an extremist because you have an opinion on anything.
Right. And you know, that's kind of, there's a certain randomness to politics when it comes to things like that too, because you wind up, I mean, right now it's, you know, if you're pro-Palestine, you're sending one message. If you're pro-Israel, you're sending a different message. And there's accusations of being extremists. But nobody's going to get in trouble right now for standing up and saying, I'm pro-Ireland, right? I mean, that's not... 30 years ago, if you stood up and said, I'm pro-Ireland, that really meant something.
Or 100 years ago.
Well, but 30 years ago, I mean, you know, because there was a...
They saw the troubles going on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The troubles.
Yeah,
the troubles.
The troubles, right. Yeah. But that's passé. You know, I don't know. Sadly, the Israel-Palestinian conflict seems a little bit more perennial than other conflicts like that.
I'd say 2,000 years or
but
so.
But yeah, I mean, you know, if you stood up and said, I'm pro-Ukraine, if you said that even 10 years ago, it would have meant like absolutely nothing. But there were people, right? I mean, there are people that are they're pro-Ukraine no matter what season it is. and I think there's probably even more that are anti-Russia no matter what season it is.
And if you stand up and say you're pro-American, you're a nationalist and an extremist.
Maybe, but no. I mean, once again, I think there's a certain randomness to that as well, that being pro-American in certain times and in certain eras was a definite positive in your camp.
Teach high schoolers.
And you know, I mean, then, right, exactly. Right now, it's not. Right now, it's not popular. So there's an element of popularity behind those types of things, more than virtue and vice, right? Because
perhaps
you can be pro-America at certain times. That can be a virtue. There can be other times where if you stand up and say I'm pro-America, that might actually show that you have a vicious character at certain times. So it all depends on the time and timing of it, that there's a very random element to
But there's something that isn't random, and good is always good. Evil is always evil. Nobody can be fully good. Nobody can be fully evil, because evil does not exist in and of itself, right?
Right, that's true. Right. So if you came out and said, I'm pro-evil or pro-good, those tend to not have the fad to it.
Right.
And same thing, I think if you came out and said, I'm pro-virtue and anti-vice, you know, once again, I think that has a more permanent element to it than really any of these other issues that are political. Hence, I think Socrates' critique of people that throw around the political topics as being sophists. Those things change. They change over time. They're not permanent.
I think one of the most difficult things about the subject that we're talking about is the terms and how terms change and shift over time. So to say, For me, if someone says to pro-American, in my mind, I'm going to start categorizing. Well, these are probably the things that person is affirming by that statement. But at the same time, depending on the setting, if someone says to pro-American, people have said that they're pro-American and said things that I would say are pretty anti-American about it. It depends on how they're approaching the topic. And so there's always a second question that has to be asked. If someone says I'm pro-American, and there's someone I don't know very well, I would say, well, great, glad to hear that. I'm an American too. Like, what do you mean by that?
Right.
Yeah, what comes to mind in terms of
what is it you're extolling?
Yeah. Right.
The intention of the media by which it's received. So, as an example, I was watching one of the sports ball games last night, and I guess during one of the commercial breaks, trivia came on one of the billboards at the Michigan State Michigan game, and a picture of Adolf Hitler was shown within the trivial context, and the athletic director came on and made this big apology about how Adolf Hitler, his image was shown, and you know, they don't stand by that, and the third party company that was doing the trivia, it had been fired on the spot, and they should have done a better job. Now, to show a picture of somebody who has arguably historically, you know, the most evil man in the 20th century, as being the picture itself as an evil without the context of understanding if it was a trivia question. So there's a lot of, it appears to me, there's a lot of this holding up of virtue, but also denying the vice behind it. And also, and likewise, there's a holding up of vice and denying the virtue behind it. Not saying that Adolf Hitler himself was a paragon of virtue, because we all know he was not. But the question still remains, we have this society where on television, in media, in the context, there are things that are being presented and completely whitewashed or denied as being either virtuous or vicious, but only within the context that it's given. We're forgetting that virtue itself exists and vice itself exists. And what happens to a society when viciousness is held up as a good? Well, virtue then becomes the villain.
Right, right. And I think, you know, to put it in more, you know, looking at censorship, right? You know, somebody censoring somebody else's message for political gain, I think is, I hate to use the term universally wrong, but it's wrong. Generally sure. Speaking, censoring somebody else. But when you're talking about pictures, when you're talking about messages, there's a lot of censorship that can go on that gets extolled in terms of virtue. Yeah, it's virtuous to not have to expose people, do certain things that they don't want to see. And then that's used as a way to censor. And yeah. And so you have, you know, basically virtue being extolled in the name really of committing a vice.
Sure.
And so, yeah, you've got virtue and vice that have been pretty much reversed in that context.
Yeah. And there's an internet meme where it shows a nuclear family going to church. And the meme says something along the lines of, you know, become the extremist that the world already thinks that you are. And so that, you know, that raises a question I really want to get into. And it's, is the nuclear family really the new form of extremism in the American context?
Ah, and, well, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back here on the Catholic Cave, we will dive right in. You're listening to the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Is life overcoming you? Or are you overcoming life? Because that's what we're here to help you do. Catholic Radio Indy.
A little motherly advice from Marcy Rankin from CelebrateMarriageMinistry.com.
As a mother of six, it's easy to get distracted by the children. I enjoy listening to Catholic Radio Indy because it helps me remain centered in my faith. When I'm on the way to get the kids from school, or whether I am running errands every day, I can listen to shows like Dr. Anders talking about the richness and fullness of our faith, Dr. Ray Gurundi giving great advice and encouragement to parents and families, and as well as the local Faith in Action program that features local people just living their faith in their daily lives. It's a great tool, and I hope that you can recommend it to all the moms that you know.
Covering life from a position of good news. Share the joy. Listen for updates. Discover life. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Joseph Tomasian, and we're talking about extremism, but we're also talking about virtue and vice. You know, we're trying to parse what it is about all of the accusations of extremism that go on during political season mm-hmm. that really rankles people. I mean, why is it such a bad thing to be called an extremist? As I said, nobody really wants to go down on the record as being mediocre. So I know the opposite of extremism is moderation when you're talking politics, but still, there are some things that are good to be in the extreme camp for virtue mainly. And you definitely want to be extremely against vice, whatever that vice might be,
wherever it exists.
And, you know, generally those things are, you know, what extremism and moderation gets attached to tends to come and go in politics. But I think you're right, Joseph. You ended talking about the family and being in support of the family being seen, at least now, and I think growingly so, as being an extremist. And yeah. that's a dangerous trend.
Well, here's the thing. In today's context, to be called an extremist means that there's a sense of irrationality that gets attached to what it means to be an extremist. And of course, what we know of that is religious fundamental extremists committing atrocities overseas against whoever they deem to be other. And so to be called an extremist, there's this idea that essentially you have a tendency towards violence, that you have this high capacity towards violence, and there's an attachment to the patriarchy, there's an attachment to not being civil. So it's almost, being called a barbarian back in the 1400s, somebody's barbaric, they're uncultured, uncivilized. And so to be labeled as an extremist almost has that sort of cultural dog whistle that you are should be harnessed and done away with, that you don't belong in civil society. So to be nuclear, to proclaim the virtues and traditions that we've upheld for eons, and to say that if you're pro-life, you're an extremist. Well, gosh, I just don't think that's, I know what pro-life and I know what extremism are supposed to mean in a modern context, but when you put them together, it no longer sits well.
Right. Because, when most people are talking about being pro-life, they're talking about being against abortion. Right. I mean, that's generally and honestly, yeah, the political winds have only shifted. And I don't even think they really have. I think if you polled the majority of the public and you said, look, when is abortion acceptable? I think the majority of people would have a very narrow range of acceptability. Mm. And I think as Catholics, that's something we need to work on, of educating people to get that down to recognizing, protection of the preborn is necessary, no matter development, no matter circumstances, etc. But nonetheless, all that to say, being pro-life is not an extreme position if you look at, I think, majority opinion, but it's being painted as such mm-hmm. For political gain. And in the process, yeah, it's distorting what is upheld as sort of a normal, normative view and turning it into something that they're trying to portray as being outside of the political norm.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think something similar has happened with Second Amendment issues, right? I mean, it's only been recently that if you said, no, I believe in the Constitution, I believe in the Second Amendment, I do think the founding fathers had some wisdom when that Second Amendment was put in there, and I don't think we should go willy-nilly trying to ignore the Constitution. It's only been very recently that's considered an extreme position.
Yeah, and there's this great push that we've seen in the past 7 to 10 years or so, where any sort of display of a capacity of violence has to be squashed, because that makes you an extremist, because that's what we've seen on the news. If you have the capacity for violence, that is not good. Well, there are others out there. Jordan Peterson is one that who very famously goes into, you know, quite elucidative detail about what it means to be virtuous. And first and foremost, if you're a man and you do not have a capacity to be violent when the time calls for violence, that's weakness, and weakness can never be good. If you're a man and you do have a capacity for violence, but you withhold that capacity, that's the only way in which you can be virtuous. You can only be good because you recognize within yourself that you do have a capacity towards violence. And so the people who are pro Second Amendment and pro life, it seems so you're pro violence but also pro protection. Well, these are very masculine traits, and to be both of these is considered extremism in today's worldview.
Yeah, and I think it's a matter of what is being empowered there in both those contexts, because I think both of those particularly revolve around the protection and promotion of the family.
Sure.
As sort of the central unit of society. And I think there's a growing chorus that wants to more or less take the family out of the picture so that we simply have society of individuals, and yeah, those individuals represent their own individual views. The raising of children is, you know, that becomes a communal effort. You know, it takes a village to raise a child type of mentality. Yeah. Yeah. And so then you just have individuals and you have the government protecting individual rights, a la Hobbes, right?
Yeah.
So the other things, you know, in between are, they are threats to a certain extent to other people's liberty and other people's freedoms, yeah, other individuals' freedoms. And, you know, that's not the way we as Catholics see family. And that's not really, I think, the way I think Christianity as a historical movement in general has seen family.
Well, we've thrown around the terms virtue and vice. How would you guys define those terms?
Historically?
Yeah, or right now.
Yeah, well, I would say virtue is anything that leads to promotion of an established good, and a vice is anything that detracts from that. And so you can have virtues and vices in a number of things. You know, changing your oil every 3,000 miles or every 3 months is the virtue. It's a virtuous practice for good auto mechanics, right? So if you wanted to maintain your car, that's something you have to do. That becomes a virtuous action because that helps maintain a well proper, you know, operating vehicle, and that's considered an established good. When you're talking on a global scale, you have to have some notion of what is good for happiness, what is good for overall, I hate to use the term because it gets thrown around, but human flourishing, because to me that's a very pagan term, but I think you know, it's something that people can latch their, but you have to have some concept of the good society and what's good for society.
Wow.
And a virtue then is that which promotes that. A vice is that which stands in the way of becoming a good society. Now, here's the bottom line. Are there virtues and vices that clash depending on if you're talking about the good of a family versus the good of society? And that, I think that's where that Second Amendment debate comes in. People look at the good of society and they say, look, you know, we have a huge amount of violent crime. That violent crime tends to be perpetrated by handguns. What would be virtuous for society is to do away with the handguns, but what's virtuous for a family is protecting your family. And so doing away with handguns eliminates that ability to protect your family. And so there's almost a clash of virtues,
yeah,
involved in that.
You know, historically, virtue comes from the Latin word vir, man. Right. And so the manly actions, those that promote virtue, also reveal virtus, truth. And so within the action of what is virtuous, you're moving towards truth, you're moving towards goodness. And so I think the greatest virtue that Aristotle holds up is the good, right? And so virtue itself would be moving towards the good. At breaking this down a bit more philosophically, it's following the final causality for the thing itself. As a human, what does that mean? Moving towards the good. Well, as a Catholic Christian, that means aligning my behaviors with the cross, keeping my eyes ever fixed on the cross, and doing what is right, doing the next right thing, keeping in mind that I am, you know, not only a procreator, but a provider and a protector. And in doing so, making the decisions that are going to help that flourishing, that human flourishing that you indicated, those would be virtues. And it's hard to pinpoint each particular behavior and sort of wrap your mind around what is virtue, but we know what virtue is not. And so the opposite of virtue is vice, viciousness.
Right.
And, you know, theologically speaking, nobody sins for the sake of sinning. People sin because they think a good will come from it, even a perceived good, rather than an actual good. So if I rob a bank, the good is I get more money, right? I don't rob a bank because it's evil. I rob a bank to get money, which is a perceived good.
Right, but what makes it... Okay, so it's an action for a perceived good. Mm-hmm. What then is it that makes it a vicious action rather than a virtuous action?
Well, it's thievery, first and foremost.
But why... I guess the bottom line question there is, why is thievery a vice where toiling and working hard to earn a dollar is a virtuous action?
Yeah, well,
they're both for the same end. What distinguishes one from the other?
Well, JP2 would say that you know, vocation, work, fulfills our deepest desires. You know, being able to do the thing is fulfilling. So, entering into the vocation of being a father, of being a husband, of you know, whatever our everyday jobs are. And so vocation is a fulfilling thing, but taking away from others would be vicious. And I think that's the great distinction.
I would say there's a communal element to it. And whether it's a communal element that comes from our relationship with God, you know, we're made in the image and likeness of God. Therefore, we are made to have community with God. And doing something like stealing from a bank breaks that relationship with God. It breaks that relationship with others.
Sure.
So there's an element of communality. And so vices harm the good of the community. You can't just do something just because it's good for yourself.
Sure.
You have to do something that is good for the entire community. And if that entire community extends universally to God, then there are universal virtues that supersede even the virtues for our own country, our own nation, our own cities.
Yep. Well, we've got to take a break right now. When we come back, maybe we'll pick that up. I got a few thoughts on virtue and vice myself. I might weigh in.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back here on the Catholic Cave, we will dive right in. You're listening to the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Do you like game shows? How about trivia? You're listening to Catholic Radio, so I assume you're interested in the Catholic Church. Catholic Challenge 2.0 is the newest addition to our programming lineup here on Catholic Radio Indy. A 30-minute quiz show covering almost everything Catholic. Catholic Challenge 2.0 tests your knowledge and teaches at the same time. Check it out every Thursday afternoon at 4:30 right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
This is Gordon Smith. I'm interviewing Father Brian Dozinski today from St. Maria Goretti Parish in Westfield, Indiana.
I really think Catholic Radio is a great evangelization tool. When I was at St. John Vianney, we were very supportive of Catholic Radio, and one of the ways I promoted it was saying, hey, you may not get Catholic Radio, you know, because sometimes the reception wasn't good, or maybe they just didn't listen to it. And I said, there are different mediums for evangelizing and sharing the faith, but I've heard so many conversion stories about people who just happen to turn on Catholic Radio and hear something on that program that really helped them either to look into the Catholic faith or come back to the Catholic faith. And so I'm a very strong supporter of Catholic Radio and all the good that they do to not only build up the faith, but to spread the faith and help others to embrace it as well.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell in here with Joseph Tomasian as well as Mark Tuttle. Last segment, we were talking about virtue and vice. I wanted to weigh in just a little bit. Here we were talking about different ways to define it. The way I think about virtue and vice, we're talking about like how do we know it's vicious? I would say, Mark, you're getting us there. If it violates the natural moral law, that's going to be something that's vicious. Something that's virtuous is something that's going to comport with the natural moral law. And virtue and vice both are stable habits of the soul. So these are things, so I become more virtuous as I acquire more of good habits that aim at the good. And the good being not just defined as something that's desirable, but remember Aquinas and Aristotle talk about the good as meaning also being synonymous with being and perfection. So when we say something's good, we not only mean that it's desirable, but the reason why we desire something that's good is that there's something perfecting about it. It's something that makes it more of what it makes by acquiring, makes us more of what we think or perceive that we are or should be. But that's where I would go. And I think of cardinal virtues as another quick way to kind of anchor the conversation a little bit, mm-hmm. which when you think about whether it's prudence, temperance, fortitude, or justice, These are things that are located. The other thing I was going to bring up too is these things are things that are located in the soul, and I don't believe processes necessarily are virtuous. The processes are I would move that more towards a discussion about like means and ends. And
I don't know. I don't circumstances. I mean, processes when you're talking about temperance, processes when you're talking about fortitude. Those things have to do with processes. So I'm not sure that a process is completely divorced from the discussion, but I get what you're saying.
I mean a process devoid of humans. Like humans can be virtuous or vicious. I don't know that other inanimate objects, for example, can't be.
You need an agent of an action. Right. In order
you need a moral agent. That's how we know using natural moral law whether something's virtuous or vicious. That's the yardstick.
So the question is, the nuclear family and extremism, what are we doing with that?
Yeah, why is it in the modern society that being pro-family, so to speak, becomes more and more being portrayed as being not just extremist, but extremely vicious. In other words, it's a vice to put your family first in today's day and age.
It's a feature of cultural Marxism. Well, that's what I would say.
No, to be sure. And the idea that a husband, a father, children, dad working, mom staying home, which does not happen that often today. But let's say dad works, mom stays home, helps around the house with the kids, which is a massive, massive undertaking. And not many people have that luxury to be able to do that with, things cost money and to live today is expensive and groceries cost more and gas and everything else. So to live that sort of traditional lifestyle, has a lot of hearkening to patriarchal societies and the haves and the have-nots. And so if you have a nuclear family that has a very traditional lifestyle, there's this connotation that you're going to be automatically against the other. And so
it's not, it could be that. I also would say, it could be that. I think the reason, because I love that question, Joseph. I think why the nuclear family, the traditional family, draws so much fire is because when you arrange your household that way, it excludes lots of other things that lots of parts of society would say would be our goods, and you're denying those.
Same-sex households. Single mothers.
On and on and on. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and I think even
heteronormativity, I learned that one since we last met.
I think you're also making a statement about the supreme good.
yeah.
That sort of contradicts what other people have put out at the stream. Good. You know, if you say, look, raising my kids to be virtuous, and the best way to do that is to have both a mom and a dad present in their lives, spending time with them, yeah. etc., and you put a premium on that, what you're saying is not important is maximizing the amount of wealth I can make, maximizing my power in society, maximizing the impact I can have in my community. You're kind of saying that all of those things are subservient to raising my kids in a particular way. And that, I think, rankles a lot of feathers, because a lot of people have put so much stock in these other things that they see as supreme goods.
So would you guys say that the normative family, the I don't even know if I can say that, the nuclear family, mom, dad, children, it quietly articulates an unspoken truth of what you say is good, and thereby the rest of society is left to interpret that other than that is bad.
No, I think there's a natural component to it. Yeah, there's a natural component.
Tim says
to
no, it. Mark says yes.
I think there's a natural component to the family that sort of transcends just that level of opinion.
Here's what you're not allowed to do. Yeah. And here's why it rankles. I agree with you. It rankles because it causes us to use terms that are no longer acceptable, which are what? Good, better, or best.
Oh, I
like you're
with
not
that.
Allowed to do that anymore. Everything has been replaced with what? Different. Equal. You can't say that's Equal. A better.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't say that's a better arrangement for a household or rearing children or finding happiness. You have to say
that's
it's
a judgment.
Different.
And
that's
to, right. And to be judgmental today
yeah,
is
that's right.
Yeah, that's yeah,
shame
anathema.
On, you know, I shame think that's on you a, and me.
Yes.
No, but I think
but
that's
you can't
a,
say better
yeah,
or
yeah,
best.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah, the virtue of tolerance. And there's a lot of people that would say it's a vice, and I think there's a strong argument to say it's a vice, but I think that's a question of that probably deserves its own show topic.
Look up Fulton Sheen, anyone listening, his quote, I don't have it at my finger. He has a lot. Fulton Sheen has a very, sharp criticism of tolerance, because he says tolerance is not the great. This is the mistake I think that we face in society and part of the culture now. Tolerance has been elevated beyond its path where it belongs on the list of virtues. I think it can be a virtue because a lot
tolerance
of Augustine's
is the good.
City, it's the highest good, or it's too high on the list, because tolerance we never have to accept tolerate. Falsehoods. Yeah. Like that's Fulton Sheen.
Yeah.
You never have to tolerate falsehoods. You never have to tolerate evils, right? And so those things should be what? Confronted and corrected. Tolerance gives us all, this is why relativism has such a reign over people's minds and hearts, because it allows a non-confrontational sort of live and let live attitude. Yeah,
but here's where I was coming from when I initially answered that is I think anybody that gets beyond the pointy-headed academic approach to the question of the family and they look at the concrete realities of life can very quickly see the best, better, worse situation. If you ask a single mom, would it be better if you were married and had somebody else that was a father to your kids? There's not a single one of them that would say no.
You'd be crucified for asking that question.
No, I don't think you would be.
Oh, my goodness,
you know, but,
yes.
But, and same thing with divorce. You know, if you ask somebody really honestly, would it be better to have two loving parents that are raising their kids together in communion rather than a divorced household?
But today, those are veiled judgments.
They're not, though. I mean,
it would be received, I
no,
believe.
No, I don't think so. I think if you, like, and that's why I say you've got to get out of the academic stratosphere of these things and look at the concrete results. People are suffering because their families are broken down, and people recognize it and see it quickly. It's not an abstract question as to whether this is better or not. It's a very concrete, real question, and people are suffering.
And that's what I'm getting at. That's exactly the point. That's the reason for the whole conversation. When you say that the nuclear family is the most important thing. It causes other people to be introspective and look at the areas in their life where they have not succeeded, where they have failed. And in doing so, it causes them to make a judgment upon themselves. And that is uncomfortable. And I think that's the whole point right there, is that when you say this is a good, it makes the rest of society become introspective and see where they have failed. And nobody wants to feel that failure because we're all told that we're amazing and great and good.
Right. Now, where I will say that, you know, possibly you will get a lot of argument back is when you're talking about the ideal of somebody looking at themselves as just an autonomous human being. In other words, is family life better for me personally? On one perspective, you can answer that very quickly and say no, because it involves self-sacrifice. It involves me putting my wants and needs and desires behind what's good for other people, behind what's good for my wife, behind what's good for my kids, behind what's good for my family. And in that sense, if you look at it, no, then family life is actually a bad for an individual. And I think you've had a lot of people that have bought into that mentality. And there's a large movement of I think, first women that said, you know, wait a second, this idea of sacrificing for the sake of the family really leaves me out from career, from wealth, from friendships, from the good life. And you have a lot of men now that I think are countering that and saying, yeah, you guys are exactly right. Me dedicating myself to a family cuts off my ability to make money, to be prosperous, to enjoy life, to have experiences. And so you have a competing, you have almost an incommensurate competition of ideal goods that I think are at the heart of this. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about that idea of incommensurability of ideal goods and how we kind of look at that at a societal level. You're listening to The Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy.
When you're tired of doing life alone, come back here. We enjoy the company. We hope you do too. Better together. Catholic Radio Indy.
When a business is looking to expand, they say it's all about location, location, location. But what about when the church needs to expand? To stretch out and reach those fallen away, estranged from the faith, or those who simply have never heard the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then it's all about vocation, vocation, vocation. We need more people dedicated to the mission of serving the church, more priests, more deacons, more men and women of vowed service, and more lay workers willing to go into the fields. The harvest is rich, but the workers are few. Is God calling you to service? Pray on it, and while you're there, pray for more vocations. A simple request from your friends at Catholic Radio Indy.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Joseph Tomasian, and we were just talking about the incommensurability of these ideals that lead to different virtues and vices, right? Mm-hmm. If you see the ultimate good as being for you personally, without any reference to God, without any reference to community, without any reference to others, you're going to have a very different table of virtues than if you see the good as laying down your life on the cross for the sake of others and therefore for sacrificing yourself for the sake of God. And you know, it kind of leaves that question of post-Christian world. You know, we've heard that term describing our society. And when I look at what seems like most people are putting in front of themselves as the ideal is wealth, it's money, it's power, and more important, it's experiences, right? Yep. You want to have, you want to be able to maximize your experience.
It's a kind of hedonism.
It's a kind of hedonism, but that has become the ideal for so many in our culture. It's led to a different table of virtues, a different table of vices, where yes, what gets seen as being virtuous for Catholics is seen as promoting vice for a culture of hedonism.
You know, I was at an Oktoberfest party recently and talking to some of the guys there, and they were asking my story and whatnot. And some people know, but many people don't. know that I was a seminarian for a very long time. And so the question inevitably arises, what made you decide to leave? And what I tell them is so foreign to them. And I think it just elucidates this. I was given the choice to either continue on to priesthood, where, you know, I saw a relative life of ease. I was going to go do this, that, and the other. And life would have been, at least from the perception at that time, fairly easy. And then the idea of getting married, I took some time off to pursue this particular question. The idea of getting married to me was, it was scary. There was the cross. There was lots of unknowns. And so I chose to move toward the cross of getting married, knowing that I was going to have to live for other instead of, the idea of, living for others as a priest is very different from living for others as a husband and father. And so I moved towards the greater of those two perceived crosses. And it's been absolutely fantastic. But the men there could not wrap their minds around why I would choose a perceived heavier cross, because the idea of sacrifice doesn't seem to be as ingrained in the people of today as perhaps it once was, or maybe that's just nostalgia. And we say that there was this great time in which virtue was, upheld as the paradigm of all manliness.
Well, it being upheld as the paradigm and having people walk that path towards virtue are two very different things. Sure. I mean, I think you're exactly right. In the past, I think that was held up as a virtue much more than it is of that, of self-sacrifice, of following and finding your cross. That's much less talked about now. But does that mean people in ages past actually did it?
Right.
That's
yeah.
another question.
Yeah.
I'll give you a quick example that I discovered. So it's available on YouTube. So there's this TV show called Here Come the Brides from 1968. And the premise of the show, really quickly, it blew me away. The premise of the show is that there's this logging camp in Northwest Washington State with about 100 bachelor men, and they all want to get married. So they send one of their men over to Massachusetts, the other side of the country. It's in the right after the Civil War, so a lot of men were killed and not available, where there's a surplus of single women, and these women get on a boat, 100 of them, and sail around. There's no Panama Canal. They sail around the South America just to be in an environment where marriage is the central good. Marriage and then raising a family. And so just imagine that you could. So it's fun to watch. It's mostly about the women sort of taming the men who are kind of goofballs.
Right,
And we know that that's what happens with marriage.
Isn't that the story at all?
It is the story.
Yeah.
But can you imagine? I mean, this I bring it up really because I'm fascinated and struck by how central and how obvious it must have been to all of America or large parts of America that you could build an entire TV series, 3 seasons, around this whole notion of marriage being the central good. That's obvious to everyone. It's the premise of the show. It's obvious to everyone that men and women would marry and raise families. And now the hijinks about how you bring that about. But what's been lost, going back to the beginning of the show, what's been lost is that's not where we're at.
No,
today.
That scene is vicious today. That scene is regressive and
especially to the women.
I
don't think so. Yeah. I think the nuclear family is under attack because it's this thing that is scary and requires sacrifice and mediocrity is much more comfortable. Instead of moving towards that which is hard, which people recognize as being an intrinsic good, because that's where all the goodness is. Do the hard things. Always choose the hard path. And in doing so, you fight that fight right now, so you don't have to fight those fights later. Not saying that there isn't fighting or struggling in marriage, but you move towards the hard, and people don't want to do that today because they don't have a full understanding of what sacrifice is.
No, because the good life is seen as an easy life, right?
Yeah,
so the
right.
good life is the good life is put out there as a life of wealth, a life of
It's me getting what I want. Whatever I want, right. that's what it's all really about.
And so if you've got a society, and we've got these two sitting in society side by side, probably more than half of society, sadly, says the hedonism is really what life is about, right? Trying to get the American dream, trying to get as much as you can, trying to have those experiences.
Do you think the American dream is hedonism?
I think a large chunk of the population thinks the American dream is hedonism now.
They're missing
Well, I think they think that.
They are. No, I agree with you. But
I would say it's happiness. Like, the new definition of happiness for a lot of people is a form of hedonism.
Right, exactly.
Like, to be happy, I have to satisfy my wants and all the constraints.
And who are you to tell me I can't get what I want?
Or tell me that my wants or desires are wrong. Don't do that.
Yeah.
But then we have Catholicism.
Who am I to judge?
Catholicism sitting side by side in this culture that puts the ideal of the cross out in front of people. And not only the cross, but the cross through marriage, right?
Yeah.
So marriage, it's just by its very nature, is self-sacrificial. It's very natural as well, right?
Yes,
I mean, we are wired for it, but it is very countercultural now because of the hedonism. And you know, these are two incommensurable goods. You can't argue against them. You can't take the cross, the logic of the cross, and argue against hedonism with them. They just don't compute. They don't even sit in the same set of
very
questions.
Different worldviews. That's the thing. And getting back to something, I know we're going to run out of time in the show, but one of the things about virtues too that's really important, because you mentioned it and we didn't really touch on it, I meant to go back to it. It's important that we think about, and this is true of philosophy or wisdom, it's things have to be put in their proper order, because sometimes you have choices between two goods that you just were describing that, Joseph. Becoming a priest, that is a very good thing to do. Becoming a husband, father, that's also a very good thing to do. So it's about being able to take these things that are good, these different virtues, and being able to prioritize them, have them in the right order, and apply them at the right time in the right way. These are things that are really important. That's what takes – it's prudential, practical reasoning, but it's also – ultimately, it's wisdom. And that's why having the faith is critical, because it's reason alone isn't sufficient. You have to have faith with reason
in order to arrive at the right pattern
for one's life.
Right. And I think that pattern, that pattern of self-sacrificial love being what ultimately happiness and virtue looks like, right?
Yeah.
That doing the hard things is what we are called to in this life. And that's really where happiness lies. We've got to get that back in front of people
as the
true good. Because I think, you know, we've completely lost sight of what it means, I think, to be fully human.
Yeah.
You know, fully human is not to be maximizing the number of experiences you can have. That's not what being fully human is.
Although it's good.
It's good.
It's a part of it.
It's a part of it. But no, I mean, you know, living on a farm where you never leave your farm, raising animals and raising a family.
That's a very, very good life.
And it doesn't have a lot of the experience that people would say, well, wow, you're just completely missing out.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the idea of love, you know, putting the good of other before your own, which is sacrifice. That's how we define sacrifice, right? Putting others' good before your own. I think if we were able to, I think that's the answer to the question here. How do I move beyond where I am now and embrace this idea of virtue? Well, stop living for yourself. You know, sacrifice every now and then. Put somebody else's good before your own. It's living the paradigm of the cross, which is in juxtaposition, moving towards the suffering, embracing that, and coming through it, understanding that in that suffering there's redemption. And that's the only thing that makes it good.
And heroic suffering is not monumental suffering, right?
Right.
That heroic suffering is literally the suffering I'm called to right now.
Day to day.
Day to day. And sometimes it looks rather mediocre rather than extreme.
Yes. Changing the diaper when you don't want to.
Right. Yep. Yep. Going out and throwing a baseball when you don't want to.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And but those things also bring tremendous joy as well. And, so I think that's where the experience and yet the putting your own desires for that experience. It's like so much of Christianity. It's a contradiction. Well, we're kind of out of time, gentlemen, and I think we've left a lot on the table to discuss in future episodes. But I think. Did we actually have an episode where we kind of accidentally landed the plane?
I think we did.
That's never supposed to happen.
Well, you've been listening to The Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to Kent@CatholicRadioIndy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.